I look back after I'd sold HomeServe for £4.1 billion 2 years ago, and instead of sort of congratulating myself, I'm sort of person that would say, if I had, maybe we could have got there as a team in 15 years rather than 30. We're really good in the UK at startups, and we're really bad at scale-ups. And if you can take a basic idea that somebody else has proven, then I'm a big believer in second mover advantage. Copy from somebody else, but then add some additional value and then go big. My business partner and I had to give up 52% of the business for our £500,000 investment. Those businesses that are still doing direct mail get a bigger share of the doormat. Just think at home, how many bits of direct mail are coming through? Hire your replacement. The bottom line is Americans buy from Americans, and you're not going to have credibility as a British business if you're sending a bunch of Brits over there, however good they are. I think one of the biggest issues with entrepreneurs is far too many ideas. We're all foxes. We need to be hedgehogs, and we need to stay really focused. Hardest lesson for us entrepreneurs and for anybody watching or listening is...
Richard, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
It's I'm really excited about this one, so let's get straight into it. We always start our podcast off the same way. So who are you and what problem do you solve?
I'm an entrepreneur through and through from about the age of 5 when I started my first business, which was breeding white rabbits and then running a rabbit kennels for the people that sold rabbits to when they went on holiday. And the problem that we need to solve as entrepreneurs is we're really good in the UK at startups and we're really bad at scale-ups. So how do we help medium-sized businesses to go from medium to large? And that's the problem that I really want to now focus on solving.
Amazing. And for anyone who doesn't know who you are, what qualifies you to be able to have those types of conversations with people?
Yeah, I'm one of only 10 entrepreneurs that's built a business worth £4 billion or more. I achieved that sale 2 years ago with HomeServe that I've been running for 30 years. And I want to take the 9 things that I know now that I truly wish I'd known at the start of my entrepreneurial career with HomeServe and get those messages out to every entrepreneur in the UK, but particularly those that are running a medium-sized business and they want to be large. Mm. Or hopefully some of those that will create the next £1 billion-plus value businesses.
Amazing. I'm excited for this one already, Richard. So I want to talk about, obviously, your characteristics that I'm sure you see in some of these entrepreneurs that can take these businesses from millions to billions. You strike me as somebody that is quite resilient, gritty, and I'd probably say curious as well. So where do you think that comes from?
I think it's sort of you're born with some of those attributes. A big believer that you can hone your characteristics, but you can't sort of completely change yourself. And I think if I was going to pick out one, I'd say that curiosity sits at the top. I want to learn new stuff every day. I think I've always been driven by market research and what customers think. And maybe could give a few examples of that. I wanted to run a mail order fishing tackle business, which was selling fly tying materials to fly fishermen that tied their own flies. And I thought, I really need to know whether there's a demand out there. So I placed a £8 advertisement in the classified section of Trout and Salmon magazine. And it said, send for my mail order catalogue. So this was it well before the days of the internet. I hadn't actually got the catalogue printed yet. I hadn't bought any of the stock. I got about 25 calls saying, oh, yes, please send me your catalogue. I had to say, well, it's actually, we've had a run on them. We're out of print. And I got on and printed it quickly. But that bit of basic market research proved the demand was there. And then I set up the business. I guess give you one more example. When I was running my ready-tied fly business and selling fly tying materials at the National Game Fair, the wives and sisters and girlfriends of all these fishermen said, oh, those colourful flies would make nice earrings. So again, that was my market research done, off with the end of the hook, on with kidney wires, and I'd launched a high fashion business.
Yeah. Wow. So it feels like so many entrepreneurs going out there, creating a solution for sometimes there isn't even the problem out there. So it sounds like you've always nailed that. So say, and I know that you sit in a lot of rooms with a lot of different entrepreneurs. Say we brought in 50 entrepreneurs today and you're sat around the room and you're talking to them all. What are the attributes do you think you need to see for them to succeed? But also, what are some of the attributes that you know are going to guarantee them failure?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest ones is, I think some of those inherent characteristics, and Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, would call them level 5 leadership characteristics. So courage, determination, resilience. The values that I live by are persistence and courage, and then integrity, which is not about honesty, because hopefully we take that for granted, but more about being able to confront the brutal facts of a situation, have those honest and open discussions, and take some action. I think the characteristics of somebody that would get in the way of success would be ego and just focusing on the numbers. So it would be about low ego, and not always right sort of characteristics, being able to roll up your sleeves, listen to other people, learn from that. Those are the things that I'd be looking for where I'm making a personal investment in somebody else's business.
Amazing. So I think we're well on our way. We're going through the 9 secrets almost organically here. So number one there, we were talking about character, right? And then the next one we talk about is copy and pivot, I believe. So how would you define copy and pivot, people who don't know what that framework is?
Yeah, and so we're taught at school, aren't we, that copying homework is bad, but in business, I think it's good. And if you can take a basic idea that somebody else has proven, then I'm a big believer in second mover advantage. Copy from somebody else, but then add some additional value and then go big.
Mm.
And I guess if I was to take an example of that, then use Synergym, which is a business that I personally invested in. It's actually a guy, one of the two co-founders was an ex-HomeServe person who was a regretted loss. And they had copied the Pure Gym model. Pure Gym was a copy of a low-cost German gym chain. And the difference was that Synergym hadn't been done in Spain. Secondly, the low-cost gym model hadn't been done in Spain. Secondly, what they did was they developed their unique characteristics for how you run a low-cost gym chain. So nobody at reception, fingerprint entry. Secondly, having some personal trainers that are in the gym, but others are beamed in from our TV studio. So it's live classes, but it's on a screen in one of our studio rooms. The clever bit is before they sign a lease to open a new location in Spain, they put up a website saying, we're opening in your community. Sign up, special discount. If we don't get 300 members signed up in a 6-week period, then we don't sign the lease on the gym.
Wow.
So we avoid opening in the wrong area where we haven't got enough demand. And then the other part of the model is local influencers and ambassadors that get a free membership. And then we have a big gym opening. It's well publicized. And we're able to sign up individual gym members at a cost of acquisition of less than €5.
Wow. Okay. So then how much do you think people need to be doing? Let's say someone's got a business idea and they're listening to this, something they've always wanted to do. How much research do you think they need to do into the competitive market, where those areas are that do need to be copied and where those areas are that do need to be pivoted?
Yeah, I think the answer is do lots of market research. I think people sometimes would be put off by saying, oh, somebody's already done it.
Yeah.
But actually, that's good. Just find a way that your idea can be done even better than somebody else's. But I'd always be looking for an idea that's been done but can be improved upon.
Nice. So we're moving nicely. So just we'll do a little interlude. Tell us about these 9 steps. Why why have you created these 9 steps to make a billion?
I look back after I'd sold HomeServe for £4.1 billion 2 years ago. And instead of sort of congratulating myself, I'm sort of person that would say, I want to look back at all the mistakes I've made, the 9 things I know now that I wish I'd known at the start of my entrepreneurial career. If I had, maybe we could have got there as a team in 15 years rather than 30. So I was determined to write those down, road test them for 18 months, and then turn them into, originally it was the 8 secrets, but there were 2 things wrong with that. Number one is we'd missed one of the secrets, which was the one about the personal characteristics of an entrepreneur, which we now call step number 9, hone your character. And then secondly, let's not call them secrets, because my objective is to get them out to every entrepreneur in this country. And there are about 1.6 million of those that are running a business that is more than just somebody that's self-employed. So they're employing 2 or more people. Really, I also want to focus on those mid-sized businesses that are employing 15 or more people, and use those steps to help them.
So I want this to be a real business masterclass for anybody that's watching. Let's run through the rest of them. What's next on the list?
So the next one would be get some coachment.
If somebody's watching this, and I'm guessing their first port of call would be, how do I get in Richard's DMs and get him to coach me? But where should people be starting when they're looking for a coach or a mentor?
Yeah, and I think if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, then I didn't know the difference between a coach and a mentor. I decided that as part of my transition from going from a hands-on founder chief exec to being a chairman and an investor and helping other entrepreneurs, I should go to INSEAD, and I trained as a business coach over 12 days over 9 months. And a coach is somebody that I describe it sort of as the X-ray machine if you're going to an A&E. It will sort of tell you what's wrong with your arm, whether you've sprained it or broken it or neither of those. And then the mentor would be the doctor or consultant that's got that medical experience, that's looking at the x-rays and deciding what the advice or prognosis is. So what we need in this country is more experienced business people towards the end of their career that will then say, I'd like to do some mentoring. Ideally, I'd like to encourage them to go and train as a business coach, so that you can then say, what are the big questions that you need to ask your coachee about what the problem or opportunity is? What could be the range of options that could help them to think about what's the right course of action? A coach is definitely not providing advice. They are facilitating. So when I am doing a coachment session, I will start in coach mode, really get an understanding of the issue or opportunity from those intelligent questions. And then we'll say, okay, what I've just found out is the following. I'm now going to revert into mentor mode and use all of those mistakes I've made over the last 35 years and some of the big achievements and the learning, and see what 2 or 3 things from what I've heard could I give advice on that you could then apply to your business. So that's the magic model of coachment. That is step number 3.
Do you think if people were, I'm excited to hear your answer on this, do you think if people were using AI, podcasts and books or any other material, rather than sitting down with a coach or a mentor, a human being, what would they be wrong? What would they be missing from that?
I think the answer is you need to do both. Taking, great believer in case studies, so looking at other role models of entrepreneurs that have really done it, ideally have built a £1 billion business or more. Looking at the how did they do it? And then going out and finding a coach or mentor.
So where does that take us next then? So we're on coaching. What's the next step?
Yeah, there is find an investor. And that's really important to do. But the key things here are, when do I do it? And the answer is, not like I did in finding Sastaff's water to put in £500,000 into my loss-making emergency plumbing business that wasn't working. Ideally, find friends and family money, prove out the model small scale, keep the losses small. Once you prove the model and then you want to go big and get into growth mode, that's probably the time to get investment, fund the growth and do it properly, enabling you to start recruiting your team and getting that expansion. I would say ideally a minority investor, so you're retaining the majority shareholding. My business partner and I had to give up 52% of the business for our £500,000 investment. It was worth it in the end, but ideally we would have given up less of the shareholding. And then most importantly, find the right sort of investor who's going to be a good cultural fit, ask the right questions that will show rather than tell, and could help you along every step of the way.
Nice. So you hear a lot of, I mean, we've had lots of guests on the podcast. You've had some horror stories around investment, things that happen post-investment. What do you think are those early warning signs or maybe questions people can ask themselves to keep that process honest and make sure they're making the right decisions?
I think making sure that the investor is backing their plan rather than arriving with their own plan that they try and impose upon the business, that they have a mindset of saying the objective here is to make that entrepreneur even more successful.
Where does that leave us now? So you've got an investor. What's the next step?
So then it's about thinking about the model. And what's great today that wasn't there in my time, in my early years, was the internet. And there are millions of online businesses. But I think the magic model I would call is bricks and clicks and paper. And what does that mean? Well, you would think in this digital age that paper is, why do we need mail shots and catalogs anymore? The answer is that they still work. And actually, they work better today than they did 5 or 10 years ago, because many businesses have said, we're going to put all our money online, paying Google for AdWords, for SEM. And actually, those businesses that are still doing direct mail get a bigger share of the doormat. Just think at home, how many bits of direct mail are coming through? It's a lot less today than it was 10 years ago. Hopefully, you remember the mail shot that comes through from one of the businesses that I'm invested in personally, that was one of the original HomeServe businesses that we acquired, Checkatrade. Hopefully everybody knows the jingle, an online platform to find local tradespeople for home improvement or repair. We put out an A4 folded leaflet through 16 million doors 6 times a year with 150 tradespeople that are in the leaflet. And you can ring that track telephone number and speak directly to a great local vetted trade. But equally, it prompts people to go online to the online marketplace and look for a wider range of trades. So a great example of paper driving clicks. Another couple of examples would be the White Company. Great business. And they use paper and catalogs, as well as having stores to supplement their online business. Charles Tirrett, the menswear, buy my shirts from there. And they have many catalogs that prompt me to go and buy. So paper's really important. And then maybe give you another example of an American business, an optician called Warby Parker. And a few weeks ago, I was in New York. I went to visit the very original store. They were an online optician business, And one of the team said, why don't we open a store in New York? Everybody else around the table said, absolutely not. Have you not read our strategy? It says we're online only. And if we open a store, it's going to increase our overheads and it will cannibalize our online business in the New York zip codes. What happened? It did the reverse. Their online business went up in New York and the business got more credibility because they put a picture of the New York store in Soho on the website, and the conversion rate from clicks to sales doubled because suddenly now they'd got the credibility of a store in New York as well as the online business. So big believer in omni-channel works.
So the credibility piece there, when we think about like the human psychology, why do you think that people are more likely to see, oh, I'm more invested in this company now because they've got a flagship store?
Because some of those customers will want to go there and touch and feel the product or the service. Doesn't necessarily need to be your whole own store. Pop-ups work. Mm. I'm investing in a business called Stubble & Co., which is fantastic backpacks. They set up pop-up stands on park runs and sell the backpacks. That model really works well. It could be opening, getting your product into somebody else's store. Another business I'm invested in is Passenger Clothing, a copy of Patagonia. And when they got into John Lewis for the first time, we tracked our online business in the postcodes around that John Lewis store. And what we found was that some people went into John Lewis, thought, wow, Passenger Clothing, this is great, really colorful fleeces, but they haven't got the right product for me or the right size. So they went online to Passenger Clothing and bought direct. But it was a successful offer for John Lewis. But it also built our brand awareness and generated some direct sales ourselves.
Nice. It sounds like there are different ways to use that as part of the marketing strategy. I want to, we have a lot of people that listen to this in like the B2B world and talking about mail. I saw a brilliant example the other day, and it was for a guttering company, and it looked like it was a handwritten message. It was printed. It looked like it had been written in felt tip, and everybody was going mad because it felt like personalized. I thought that was brilliant. If people are listening and they're B2B companies and they're wanting to break into other businesses, have you got any examples of where you can kind of use that step to make billions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that omni-channel bricks and clicks and paper equally applies B2B. So I think every B2B business should have a catalogue that is bringing to life the product or service that's being sold. Think also about having the credibility of an office. Mm. Potentially, even if it's a shared office, that could be a London address, which says that gives more credibility to the business that that we're running.
Nice. So the cogs are going here. I'm really enjoying this. What's next? What's the next step?
Next one is the hardest lesson for us entrepreneurs and for anybody watching or listening is hire your replacement. And I was about eight years into HomeServe when I realized that I was a rubbish chief exec. Too many ideas, and I'm sure somebody could run the day-to-day business much better than me. There was a guy that had come into HomeServe about a year earlier called Jonathan King. He'd helped sign up some of the water companies where we use their brand to put on our home assistance model, and doing a great job, called him into my office and said, congratulations, I'm giving you my job. You're going to become MD of HomeServe UK when we were only a UK business. That then enabled me to work on the business rather than in the business. And I started thinking about, I wonder whether HomeServe would work in a foreign country or not, knowing that he was focusing on continuing to grow the UK and that there wouldn't be that opportunity cost of the UK slowing down because my focus was now on, will HomeServe work in France or even America.
No, okay, so before we move on to the international piece then, in terms of incentivizing a replacement, so obviously it's Richard's business, Richard's going to work hard for that business, but then getting a replacement in for you, how do you make sure that the replacement is incentivized to kind of carry the baton forward and not make any mistakes or drop it?
Yeah, I think the key bit is business is all about having the leader at the top. So if we're talking about HomeServe UK, finding that great leader and then saying, we've got to pay them really well. And we've got to give them not just a good salary and an annual bonus with a set of objectives that the pair of us agree. But then there's got to be a long-term incentive, some sort of equity that will drive long-term rather than just the short-term delivery of results thinking.
Interesting. Is that equity that then grows based on objectives? I'm thinking how do you, because you could get someone incentivized for 3 years, but then maybe you've got a 10-year strategy, or is it something that's constantly evolving and changing?
Yeah, I think the long-term should really be about sort of, I think, 5 years rather than three. And if it's a public company, then it will be a long-term incentive plan, which would be sort of shares in a company. It could be a share save scheme, so that could be offered to every employee. If it's a private company, most entrepreneurs will be running a private company, and then it will be an EMI scheme. There are tax benefits of doing that, but there's a range of different options. But I think don't be afraid to offer some equity, because that will really incentivize the team at the top.
So the entrepreneurs listening, they've hired their replacement and they're thinking it's still not £1 billion turnover. What's the next step? What are they missing?
The next bit would be, I wonder whether my business would work in a foreign country.
Mm.
And the key things to consider here are, I would say that timing is really important. Many businesses could jeopardize a model if they go too early. They might get some sort of opportunity internationally, but if they haven't proven the model and it's growing really, really well in the home country, normally the UK, and then they've found somebody to focus on running the UK, that is then the time to think internationally. Equally, don't leave it too late, because you don't want to wait until UK growth has slowed down or ground to a halt. Mm. When you think about international, then think about how much of the model do I actually need to change? And I call it the 15% rule. If you need to change more than 15% of your current model, then that is too much, and rethink about that country. Because just imagine you're in 20 countries and each country is 25% different from the UK. Recipe for complexity, nightmare, potential disaster. So you really want to change the minimum that you can in going into a new country, sort of ideally 5 or 10%. There will be sort of different laws, different regulations, the marketing might be slightly different. You may have to tweak your product. If you're going to America, Americans are generally larger. So with passenger clothing, it was about bigger sizes. Mm. With Gosney pizza ovens, it was about selling the bigger oven. Americans have bigger appetites, bigger portions than their British counterparts.
I want to ask you a bit of a selfish question here, Richard, while we've got you. So we have conversations about, okay, let's take this international, and the first step would be America. So what are the boxes that we would probably have to be ticking to say this is a good idea? And then once we've ticked those boxes, where do we start?
Yeah, once somebody's decided that America looks good for the business, that the product will work without too many changes, that the timing is right, then it would be about making sure you're not doing it on a shoestring. And that means having the courage to go and hire a very good American, probably in the sort of general manager role. The bottom line is Americans buy from Americans. And you're not going to have credibility as a British business if you're sending a bunch of Brits over there, however good they are. And if you're serious about conquering America, you've got to have a physical presence. And therefore, that's why hopefully you've already raised some money. And you're then going to put some real money into the resources to make America successful. And if you're going and hiring a general manager, then I did it not early enough. We'd been in America for 7 years with HomeServe. I got a great guy that was running America. He did a really good job, but we really needed that American. And that was in 2010, when HomeServe America was making $10 million annual profit. Tom Roosen is still chief exec of HomeServe America 15 years later. And last year, we made $250 million annual profit in HomeServe North America. The power of getting a great American. You need to pay them a lot of money. They will cost between 2 and 3 times a British equivalent. That probably means that the head of your business today, whether that's you or a chief exec, will be paid less than the American that you need to hire. So back to that characteristic of you've got to have the courage to do that.
They tie quite nicely all the steps, like obviously getting the investment and then moving forward. So this might be quite an easy answer, but America's a big place. So I guess if you were thinking, and maybe this probably ties back into like the market research, but where would you be? How would you be thinking about, right, where do we go? What do we do? How are we going to attack the whole of America?
Yeah, and the answer is if you're a British business, you really want to be East Coast. Boston, New York, Washington, D.C. Then there's only a 5-hour time difference. HomeServe, we set up in Miami because we got an underwriter and a claims handler that were based there. I'm a Yorkshireman. I'm a bit tight with my money. And wanted to set up in somebody else's office at low cost. So we begged and borrowed from our underwriter, MapRay Assistance, and set up in their office in Miami. And that was the wrong place to be. We couldn't hire great Americans there. And only when we moved did that open up the right Americans, and then ultimately hiring the great chief exec that took over and really made HomeServe successful. And back to, I only really worked that out by hiring my first main mentor, a guy called Nigel Morris. He was the co-founder of Capital One, a Brit that was Americanized, lived in Washington, D.C. for 18 years, tracked him down, and he said, you can't be in Miami and you can't have a Brit as chief exec. So we listened and did those two things. We moved to Norwalk, Connecticut, an hour north of New York, and then hired an American.
Wow, amazing. So we've expanded internationally. Where does that leave us next? Where have we ended up on the steps?
We're then saying evolution, not revolution.
Okay.
And there is a role for evolution, and that is in the early stages of the business. You want to take an idea, find out that somebody else has done it and it works, and then add a bit of revolution. But revolution, when you've got a medium-sized business, is dangerous. So, but equally, you need constant evolution. And if you haven't got that, then ultimately your business will die. And I think we all know those examples, Blockbuster Video, Nokia mobile phones, Yellow Pages or Yell is a fraction of the business it was originally. Those businesses did not keep evolving over time. They got left behind and ultimately they died. So you've got to do constant evolution, one step removed from your current model. And maybe we look at Apple. And if we cast our mind back to 2012, when Steve Jobs unfortunately died, and Apple at the time was worth $300 billion. And can you remember what investors were thinking? oh, we're really worried now Steve is gone. There won't be a revolutionary new product. And the answer is there hasn't been. AirPods, Apple Watches, Apple Pay, Apple Music, Apple Store, cloud services, no major revolutionary product. And yet Apple today, before the all the issues around the Trump tariffs, Apple was approaching a business being worth $4 trillion.
Wow.
So the learning is evolution, not revolution.
Could you share something in your own journey where that applied to you?
Yeah, it was developing our products from annual home assistance cover for plumbing and drains and the underground water pipe, and saying, how about if we added on electrical cover for a power failure, the lights going off? How about if we develop boiler breakdown cover? Once we develop boiler breakdown cover, sometimes the boiler couldn't be repaired, it needed to be replaced. So why don't we then get into boiler replacements? Where I did two steps removed from the current model, like getting into furniture warranties for retailers. We didn't know anything about how to sell to retailers. We only knew how to sign up utilities to use their brand name to put on our home assistance cover for plumbing and electrics and heating. And so that was two steps removed. When we got into doing big home insurance repairs for the things that are covered on your home insurance policy, like damage following a break-in, damage following escape of water. We got into doing all of those repairs for home insurers, but it was low margin. And ultimately, we got out of that business because others could do it. And we'd got a great home assistance membership model. Why don't we just keep doing that and not be distracted by some of those other things?
Nice. Have you found any ways then, maybe for people listening, of, because we probably sound similar, where there'll be an idea every 10 minutes of something new to try. Is there something you found where we can kind of test this idea on a lower budget or with lower commitment and get that feedback?
Yeah, absolutely. That would be around the, back to step number one, around copy, pivot, test, learn, do it small scale. Only when it works do you then think big. And I think one of the biggest issues with entrepreneurs is far too many ideas. We're all foxes. We need to be hedgehogs, and we need to stay really focused, put our prickles up when somebody comes up with a harebrained idea and say, no, we're just going to keep going with our clear focus strategy, and we're going to have a not-to-do list. And that is that step number eight. And the key bit is every entrepreneur should think about answering three questions. Question number one is about what are you passionate about in your business? That will normally be your purpose. Secondly, what can you be the best at? How are you going to be different from those competitors? That's your unique selling proposition. And thirdly, how are you going to make money? Ultimately, businesses are only successful if they're making money. What's your economic engine that is going to deliver that profitability and the cash that goes with it? Answer those three questions in a sentence of no more than 20 words. We did it in my main area of focus today, which is business leader. And we said, we inspire our entrepreneur, founder, and CEO members to step change and accelerate their growth through unique content and facilitated learning. Now, anybody in business leader, the team of sort of 30 or so people that are in that business with a newly hired chief exec that's leading it, they look at that statement and they say, is what I'm doing today, tomorrow, this week, this month, this year, does it fit with that statement? And if it doesn't, stop doing it. put that on your not to do list.
So in terms of the not to do list, where do you find that entrepreneurs will massively miss the mark or answer those questions incorrectly?
Yeah, I think if where I've asked for a show of hands, or I run weekly growth workshops around my dining table in my house in Marylebone, for anybody that's running a £3 million plus revenue business, and have a show of hands and say, how many of you around my dining table have a to-do list? Almost everybody puts up the hand, because business is about getting stuff done, isn't it? Mm. It is in the businesses that that you're running. And then I say, how many of you have a not to-do list? And I put my hand up, because I've learned that step. Most people don't put the hand up. So the answer is they're not working out what should be on the to-do list and what should be on the not to-do list. For me, if you said what's on my to-do list, my not to-do list today, it would be, I never want to be a chief exec again, because I've done that. I had to step back into business leader for about 6 or 7 months and be the acting CEO until we brought in a great chief exec to run the business that we've now done. I don't ever want to do a startup again, or help startups, because there's lots of people that are doing that and that's really worthwhile. But I want to be helping those scale-ups that say, I've got a business running, it's turning over between 3 and 100 million, and help me to work out how I get that sort of 10-year growth print of taking the 9 steps, getting them in the right order, and becoming a large company.
Lovely. This has been a real business masterclass. Obviously, we've got the book coming out, which goes into so much more detail. Is there anything left? Is there anything missing that you want people to take away and implement straight away?
I think the key thing would be go online and pre-order a copy of the book. It's called How to Make a Billion in 9 Steps. And I hope that it really helps. If you are a business that's in mid-size and you are already turning over more than £3 million, then come to one of my growth workshops. I'd love to meet you in person. If you haven't quite got there yet, take a subscription to Business Leader magazine, and hopefully that will inspire you with case studies of many other entrepreneurs that have been successful, not just me. And it will also answer some of the how. How can I not just be inspired, but work out how I grow my business from here?
Amazing. Thank you so much,
Richard.
Thank you.